Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. This is part 5 in our 10-part audio series looking into the history of Afrin.
That's right.
And today, we're really zooming in, aren't we? Focusing exclusively on one specific time, Afrin's integration into the Ottoman system.
Exactly. We're talking about the period starting around the 16th century, going right through until 1918, the end of the empire.
So the idea is to understand how this region, Kurdog, you know, historically, how it actually fit into that massive Ottoman structure.
Mm-hmm. And we're using the sources provided, Ottoman documents, where available accounts from travelers who were there during that time, academic analysis, but all strictly focused on that Ottoman era.
Right. No jumping ahead. And these sources, they give different angles, don't they? Admin, economy, social life, how outsiders saw it.
Yeah, it's definitely a multifaceted picture. We're trying to piece together what life was like in Kurdog under Ottoman rule based on what these materials tell us.
Okay, so let's get into it. The region comes under Ottoman control, broadly speaking, after events like Marj Dabiq in 1516.
And Sultan Selim entering Aleppo in 1517. That's the wider context.
So how did the Ottomans initially set things up there? What did the administration look like in the early days?
Well, early records from the 16th century mention the area as the Kamnahai. You have to think of the Ottoman system in layers, Vilayet, then Sanjak, then smaller units like Kazas or Nahis.
Okay.
Kurdog was part of what was called the Levai Azez ve Ekrad.
The district of Azez and the Kurds.
Precisely. Established around 1536.
Hmm.
And Jindires is specifically identified as the main village for this Kamnahi, this subdistrict.
And there was a particular system in the Kili Sanjak, which included Kurdar early on?
Yes. From about 1527 into the early 17th century, they used something called the Yurtluk-Okekluk system.
Yurtluk-Kuklik. What did that actually mean on the ground?
It's fascinating, really. It wasn't about absolute direct control from the center in every aspect. Instead, this system granted hereditary administrative rights and revenue rights to powerful local families.
Hereditary, so passed down.
Yes. Like the Kanpolato Zulara, sometimes called Jambulad. This strongly suggests that, certainly in this early phase, there was a pretty significant degree of local Kurdish control operating within the Ottoman structure.
So the Ottomans were deliberately working with existing power structures.
Seems so. It looks like a conscious strategy co-opting established local power rather than trying to completely dismantle it. We see it clearly with Izzeddin Bey.
Who was he?
The sources describe him as a prominent local Kurdish tribal leader, an Asheret Reisi. And around 1536, he's appointed as the Sanjak Bey, the governor of the whole Kilia Sanjak.
Wow. So appointing a local tribal chief as governor, why would he do that?
Well, it served several key purposes, really. First, it likely made integrating the new territory smoother, less resistance.
Makes sense.
Second, stability, especially important on a border region, often facing the Safavid Empire, their main rival.
Right, the border.
And third, critically for the Ottoman state, taxes. Securing revenue, especially from groups that might be harder to track, like nomadic or semi-nomadic tribes. Some records even call them Ikrari Zedinli, tying them administratively to Izzeddin Bey. Loyalty on the frontier was vital.
It sounds quite pragmatic, actually. Not just imposing rule, but finding ways to work with the local reality.
Very much so. Now, the governorship of Kilis did pass to others later bays, from Ediaman, a Budak Bey, around 1550-51. But that early period really establishes this pattern. A recognized role for local Kurdish leaders. And, well, a kind of negotiated autonomy within the empire.
And this connection to Kilis, administratively and economically, that was pretty consistent throughout the Ottoman centuries.
Absolutely. That link between Kurdag and Kilis is a constant thread.
Yeah.
Whether Kilis was designated a province, a sanjak, or a kaza at different times, that fundamental administrative and socioeconomic tie remained. It really defined the region's place within the larger Ottoman world.
Okay, let's shift focus a bit. What about the economy? Land, livelihoods. How did people actually make a living in Kurdag during this long period?
Fundamentally, the economy was tied to the land, to the geography. Land ownership generally followed the Ottoman norms. You had miri land.
State-owned.
Right, probably most of the farmland. Then mulk, which was private ownership, maybe more common for things like valuable olive groves. And waqf land, set aside for religious or charitable purposes.
And the sources mention the 1858 Ottoman Land Code. That sounds like a big deal. Did it change things dramatically?
It was meant to be a huge reform across the empire. The aims were, you know, to clarify who owned what, register land properly for taxes, and increase the state's control. But putting it into practice was messy. It varied a lot by region, and it was definitely open to local manipulation.
So what might have happened in Kurdaw specifically?
Well, the sources don't give us specific court records from Kurd Dagh itself for that time, which makes it hard to be precise. But looking at the broader pattern, it's plausible, even likely, that the code ended up strengthening the hand of the established landowning agas.
The local notables we mentioned?
Exactly. Often people with tribal lineage whose power was shifting more towards land ownership. The registration process could formalize their claims, sometimes perhaps at the expense of peasants who had traditional rights to the land, but maybe not the paperwork the state now wanted. So it could have actually increased inequality and maybe led to more disputes over land down the line.
Interesting. So it potentially solidified power, but maybe shifted its basis slightly more towards formal ownership.
Yeah.
Okay, so economically, what were the main activities? You mentioned agriculture.
Absolutely central. And olives. Olives became really prominent. The sources talk about Kurd Dagh being famous for its extensive olive groves. That suggests a real specialization in what was a valuable cash crop, probably responding to demand from markets like Aleppo.
And farming methods.
Probably quite traditional, you know, similar to what was common across the wider Aleppo province in the late 19th century. Nothing particularly unique mentioned in the sources there.
But it wasn't just farming.
Oh, no. Pastoralism, raising animals, was vital too, especially in the more mountainous parts. We know from the 16th century onwards, nomadic and semi-nomadic Kurdish tribes were present, and they played a big economic role, providing wool, meat, dairy products, and also importantly, transportation, camels, horses.
And where did the olives, the wool, the grain go?
The economy was really oriented towards the big urban centers nearby Kilis, and especially Aleppo. Those were the main markets for selling surplus produce. Olive oil, olives, grain, animal products, they all flowed towards the cities.
And they buy things there too, presumably.
Exactly. Goods they couldn't produce locally. It was a fundamental connection, that Kilis-Aleppo axis. But it also meant the region was quite dependent on those external markets, on the trade routes, the infrastructure connecting them.
And Afrintown itself emerged later.
Yes. The sources note Afrintown starting to grow as a local market center, particularly in the 19th century.
Are there specific examples of, say, processing industries?
Yes. The sources mention olive oil presses called Biran locally, and also soap factories. These were apparently found in areas like the Afrin, Shiran, and Jindair sub-districts. So some local processing of that key olive crop. And grape cultivation, viticulture, which had ancient roots there, also continued through the Ottoman period.
What if farming or herding wasn't enough? Did people move for work?
Yes, that seems to have been quite common. Seasonal migration or circular migration, mainly to Aleppo for work, was a really important strategy for many families.
So they go work in the city for a while.
Right, maybe during the agricultural off season, or if their landholding was small and they needed extra income. But crucially, they'd still maintain their ties, their land, their interests back in Afrin. It was a way to supplement livelihoods.
Let's talk about the social side. How was society structured during this Ottoman era?
Well, historically, tribal structures were really fundamental to Kurdish society in Afrin. And the influence of prominent Aga families, those local leaders, certainly persisted. Their power was rooted in that tribal lineage, but as we discussed with the land code, it became increasingly linked to land ownership and local political clout.
And the Ottoman state interacted with these agas.
Yeah, the sources suggest the state sometimes deliberately worked to bolster the position of certain agas. Why? Because they could act as intermediaries, help maintain order, collect taxes, basically, facilitate Ottoman administration at the local level.
But there's some debate about how powerful the big tribal groups remained over time.
Yes, that's something scholars discuss. Did state centralization gradually weaken the political punch of the large confederations? Maybe. But even if so, the influence of individual agas, controlling land and acting as local power brokers, seems to have remained very significant right through the period. Kinship, lineage, land, these were still key markers of status and influence.
What about religion? What was the religious makeup of Kurd Dagh?
The majority was Sunni Muslim. But the sources are clear, there were other important communities too. Most notably, a significant Yazidi population.
And they were concentrated in certain areas.
Yes, the sources list specific villages where Yazidis were prominent places, like Basafan, Kimar, Gazawiya, Iskan, Shedir, Burj Abdallo, Ain Dara, Kifirzit.
And for the Yazidi community, the landscape itself held religious meaning.
That's a really crucial point highlighted in the sources. There's shrines, specific mountains, other sacred sites. These weren't just places on a map. They were deeply connected to their faith, their identity, their history, their connection to that specific land. Pilgrimage sites, centers of community life.
Were there Sufi orders active as well?
Yes. Definitely. The sources mention Sufi orders like the Naqshbandiya and the Rifaya having a presence. They even name figures like Sheikh Hassan al-Naqshbandi.
Who was he?
Described as a major sheikh in the region. Yet as a Zawiya, kind of Sufi lodge or Sidr in Afrin itself, which attracted pilgrims. This points to, you know, spiritual authority being passed down through certain families over generations.
And these Sufi networks, they played a social role beyond just the spiritual.
Oh, absolutely. What's really interesting is how they seem to have functioned as links between rural Kur Dagh and the city, especially Aleppo. Think about that seasonal migration we mentioned.
Right, people going to Aleppo for work.
These Sufi networks could act as vital conduits. For someone moving from a village in Afrin to work in Aleppo, a Sufi lodge in the city could be a crucial support system, a place to connect with others from back home, get help navigating city life, and importantly, maintain their cultural identity.
How so?
Well, for instance, sources mention using Kurmanji, the Kurdish dialect, in rituals within these urban lodges. It allowed people to stay connected to their roots, their language, their community, even while living and working away from home.
So they bridged the rural-urban gap in a way.
Exactly. And maintaining allegiance to sheikhs back in Afrin, making pilgrimages to important local shrines like Nabi Huri, another prominent site, mentioned all this reinforced a shared identity tied to their home region. These networks were like an informal social glue.
The sources also mention traditional customs, like marriage practices.
Yes, marriage, or exwasgini as it's called, was obviously central to social life, often arranged not just between individuals, but sometimes seen as alliances between families or lineages.
A formal process.
Very much so. It involved elders visiting, background checks, you could say, on the groom and his family.
No.
Specific rituals, too, like serving water to the potential in-laws during the formal request. There were even folk beliefs tied to it, like if someone dropped a sugar cube, it meant a proposal was coming. And elder women often played key roles, like presenting engagement gifts.
And gender roles. How were they typically defined?
It was generally a patriarchal structure. Men were usually the heads of households, more involved in work outside the home, trade, public affairs. But women were absolutely essential to the household, the local economy, and they often wielded significant informal influence within families and the community.
But it wasn't uniform.
No, the sources suggest a woman's agency could vary quite a bit, depending on her social class, her family's tribal standing, maybe even the specific part of Kur Dagh she lived in.
And there's that striking example of Kara Fatima Khanum.
Yes. She's mentioned as a military leader, apparently commanded a Kurdish battalion fighting for the Ottomans in the Crimean War, which was mid-19th century.
A woman commanding soldiers.
Exactly. It's a powerful example showing that, despite the general patriarchal norms, it wasn't impossible for women in Ottoman Kurdistan during this era to reach positions of considerable influence, even military leadership. It complicates a simplistic view.
As we get towards the end of the Ottoman period, how did outsiders, particularly Europeans, see this region?
Well, an interest in northern Syria definitely picked up among European travelers in the decades before World War I. You had French travelers visiting the broader area, people like Volney, Pujolah, Barrez.
And what were their perspectives like?
Often, their writings reflect what we now call an Orientalist viewpoint. They might contrast the contemporary Ottoman reality, which they sometimes saw as decadent, with the region's ancient or classical past, its perceived former glory.
But some were doing more systematic work.
Yes. Figures like Gertrude Bell and Max von Oppenheim stand out. They weren't just passing through. They combined travel with serious archaeological investigation before the war. Their work really contributed a lot to European knowledge, or at least documentation of the area's geography, history, and its peoples. Others like Burckhardt, Ainsworth, Richard Francis Burton also left accounts.
So valuable perspectives, but need to be read critically.
Absolutely. With any source from that era, especially external ones, you have to consider the writer's background, potential biases, maybe colonial attitudes or assumptions. It's part of doing history responsibly.
And that brings us back to the challenge of writing this history in the first place based on the sources available.
It's a real challenge. Mm. One of the main difficulties is that there aren't that many sources focused only and specifically on Kur Dagh within the huge Ottoman archives. Often, we have to piece things together, drawing inferences from studies about the wider Aleppo Vilayet or Kilis or from general works on Kurdish or Ottoman history.
So it's like assembling a mosaic, maybe with some tiles missing.
That's a good way to put it. You connect the dots, you extrapolate carefully, and as we just said about the travelers, you constantly have to evaluate the sources themselves. Are there biases? colonial perspectives, later nationalist interpretations coloring how the past is presented. You have to be aware of all that to try and get the most balanced view possible.
Han, the Chai Lady, is here. Rojbosh Hannah.
Excellent. Perfect timing.
Let's see what we've got today. Implied pause for pouring, sipping Mitch. Oh, that's hitting the spot. Really nice and warm. Not bitter at all today.
Good, good. Sometimes it needs a bit more trigger, but sounds like she got it right this time.
Yep, just right. A welcome pause. Okay, right. Where were we? We were just talking about the challenges of the sources.
Mm-hmm. So if we try to pull all these different threads together, how would you summarize the way the Ottoman system shaped life in Kurda?
Well, it clearly integrated the region, primarily through those administrative links focused on Kilis, and often by working with local leaders, the agas, the tribal chiefs. The economy became deeply intertwined with agriculture, especially olives and pastoralism, and was fundamentally oriented towards those big markets in Kilis and Aleppo.
And this system interacted with the existing social fabric.
Yes, it interacted with a society where tribal structures remained important, where you had diverse religious communities like the Yazidis and Sufi orders playing significant roles, and where traditional customs continued to shape daily life.
So it sounds like integration into a huge empire, yes, but not total assimilation. It kept its own character. I think that's fair to say. It was definitely part of the Ottoman world, shaped by Ottoman administration and economy. But the sources also point to the persistence of local autonomy in certain ways, distinct regional characteristics, and the continued vitality of its diverse communities, each with strong ties to the land and their own identities.
Okay. So we've traced Afrin's story within the Ottoman system from how it was governed, the role of local figures, to how people farmed, herded, traded the different communities living there.
And how it was connected, especially to Kilis and Aleppo.
Right. And we've seen it was complex, integrated, yet distinct. So maybe a final thought for you, our listener, based on everything we've discussed from the sources. Think about this. Those connections forged over centuries under Ottoman rule, those deep ties to Kilis and Aleppo, that reliance on trade routes and external markets.
Yeah, they were absolutely fundamental to the region's life for so long.
They created opportunities, for sure, economic development, access to goods, but they also created vulnerabilities, didn't they? A dependence. So how might that long history, those specific connections, have shaped what happened next for Kurdak, especially when political changes, new borders, eventually cut right across those old established links?
It's a crucial question. How does a region adapt when the foundations it was built on for centuries are suddenly altered?
Something to reflect on. It really shows how history, those long-term structures and relationships, casts a very long shadow.
Indeed.
Thank you for joining us for this part of the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. We hope you'll join us next time as we continue exploring the history of Afrin.